Steven, can you,
I love that you can do that.
Like Google Docs or something.
Yes, and I got your acceptance.
All right, let's get going. All right, we're at staff reports. So Hans, would you come up, please? What I'd like Hans to be a little bit more specific on during this time frame is just, especially since board member Janke had some concerns about the LIDAR-based water typing project next steps. I wanted him to take a few minutes to talk about where we're going with that. And you indicated in your previous discussion that you whacked $500,000 to $250,000, and that has to be spent to by June 30th, right?
Correct.
So what are we going to do with that money? Or what are you going to do with that money?
What are you going
to
do?
How are you going to be accountable for that money?
We'll talk about that in a minute, right? Good afternoon, Chair Burnett, members of the board. I'm Hans Berzy, the Active Management Program Administrator, and I'm going to speak to the topics that you just brought up, Chair Burnett. The water type model, pilot model project that you all saw the presentation, well, most of you saw the presentation in August at the board meeting, where the University of Washington looked at the footprint of what we would get using LIDAR as a kind of a first step view of, I call it a proof of concept idea on whether or not LIDAR could improve the model sufficient that it could be used in a water typing program, and as people have talked about today, to describe or define fish habitat. And as a result of that work, it showed promise, particularly on the east side pretty quickly, but also on the west side with some nuances, that it could be used effectively toward those ends. And so the motion that you all made in the November meeting was for me to work with TFW policy to identify a study, or to put together a contract for a study design that would be using monies that we have, unspent funds that we have during this biennium, to try to tee up what it would look like to do a study and to develop a water type model. And so that was the first part. And the second part was, as a parallel track, that there was interest in default physicals and either refining or potentially changing or even defining and providing support for the current default physicals, either way, to do something similar for a study design there that would evaluate default physical criteria that could be used in water typing. So those were the two issues. And what I had indicated in November is there are a lot of different types of studies that could be used to do those two things. And the scope and the scale in which those projects or studies would be developed would have very different costs associated with those. You're doing, you know, as Luke and others have suggested, several different models across the state. You know, my working assumption is that we probably need something like 9 models to match the different ecoregions across the state. And if we went down that road, 9 models, developing study designs, if we were going to do for the different 9 models, is going to be a pretty large cost. And so that was the thought when I threw it out there. It just depends. what the reality is, what we can accomplish versus what we want. And so the thought was, in further discussion and some back and forth interaction with some documents that I prepared for policy, was to better look at what the options were on the table. And the reality is, with, you know, less than 6 months to go in developing a study design, what we really need is something that we could potentially, if you know, it shows promise, that we could apply for not a huge investment and get some results that we think would be a decision to provide a decision to say go or don't go on doing more work around the model. And so the thought was, what we really need to do is a pilot, if we decide to go down that road and implementation, is to develop a study design for a pilot that would be applied in an area where the other model failed. And if we can meet the criteria in the place where the previous model didn't work, and come up with something that's workable, then I think there's merit in trying it out. And we don't know. What could happen as a result of this study design is there could be a resounding yes, that here's a study design that'll work. Preliminary data suggests that it could meet the criteria, there's a good chance or some probability. And that would be a decision point whether to fund it or not, of course, or if it's even necessary. But that would be an informed decision. And that was the problem that we had in August, is we don't really have the next step for the model. So this would be the next step to evaluate if we want to go down the model route. Now, at the same time, it's also with the physicals. There's a lot of discussion about the suitability of the physicals. Remember, we have two sets of physicals, one east, one west. The state's pretty complex. It's a little more nuanced, I would argue, than that. But we have those two defaults. And so if there's a way to look at the defaults with the same level of precision as what we're talking about for the model, then perhaps we could get physical default criteria that would work across the state or in the different areas. And maybe that would be a more useful tool and meet the goals of the board with water typing down the road. And so the idea is, okay, well, we have this money. We have the need on the next steps. Let's see if there's something that we can do. And so that's where we landed. And in consultation with some experts that do this kind of work with remote sensing data, the question was, are they going to need to acquire LIDAR to really do an adequate job for this piece, for this study design, to really flesh it out? And I didn't know. And in November. And so since that time, I've been speaking with other people that said, they don't need a full LIDAR data set to do that. There's existing information. It will be used, it will be well informed, rather than this whole other effort that would be in not acquiring LIDAR, but buying LIDAR that already exists. And so that would be a higher price tag. So this is a way, in that discussion, it was, obvious that we're not going to need $500,000 for these two studies, and then also for the work that the university is doing to improve the areas around the roads and some other kind of nuts and bolts issues with the model follow-up to what they had done previously. So that's where we are. The proposal, it was, like I mentioned before, approved at policy to go to the study design for the physical default criteria and also the water typing model project for a study design, again, only study design, and also for the Precision Forestry group to make those changes to the model that we have that they've already been working on for us.
Okay. Any questions for board members on that? Okay. Thank you, Hans. Unless other board members would like to hear from Summit on some of the other updates, I want to go to the last one in the staff report and ask Terry Jackson to come up to the table for a moment. Terry had a long memo to us this month, quarter, but I think we're all curious. As to the two species in particular that folks might note, the Fish and Wildlife Commission had uplisted Marlon Murillette from the Canadian Lakes. And, you know, the question for Terry, I want her to address is, what does that mean to us and forest practices, or what are next steps that the State Fish and Wildlife Department is considering in that context?
Okay. Well, good afternoon, Board Chair and members of the board. For the record, my name is Terry Jackson, and I'm the Forest Habitat Section Manager under Stuntman Davis's Habitat Program in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I know that Chairman Bonatha especially wanted me to talk about lynx and murillette, but I was hoping I could give you just a bit of good news for a change, because it seems like we always have bad news, so I wanted to be able to celebrate something positive. And that is about the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon that have shown demonstrated sustained recovery. And because of that, both of those species have been delisted by the Washington State Fish and Wildlife Commission. And this took place on February 4th. And with this, with the fact that they are no longer listed, these two species are also, although they are delisted, they're still classified as protected wildlife under state law. And they're also protected under the Federal Migratory Bird Act. And for the bald eagle, they'll continue to be protected under the Federal Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. And so with this, what is the implications of them being delisted? And so along with this delisting, these species will no longer be listed under the Priority Habitats and Species list, which means that With our department's limited resources, we really need to focus our efforts on the more imperiled, sensitive species needing more conservation efforts. So with this delisting, these two species will no longer, the department will no longer be managing spatial data or giving out the spatial data for bald eagles or peregrine falcons. And for forest practices, back in 2011, I believe it was, when this bald eagle was delisted or downlisted from threatened to sensitive, they were no longer protected under the forest practices rules. However, at that time, we continued to provide spatial data, and we screened FPAs for proximity to eagle nest, and then we notified landowners of that proximity to eagle nest, and notified them at that time that they needed to contact U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So at this point onward, we won't be screening FPAs for the two species. But with that said, the landowners will still need to be compliant with federal guidelines and laws. And we have, you'll see in the letter that you received, the update, and I think there'll be other guidance probably provided from DNR operations on this, that landowners will just need to go directly to the website on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to deal with the decertification, the self-certification tool for eagles. But I just wanted to share that because we don't often get to see that there's species that actually get recovered, that we can start focusing now on some other species. So then moving on to lynx, as you saw in the memo, also on February 4th, the Fish and Wildlife Commission made their decision to uplist the lynx to state endangered went into effect. And this was pretty much, this was all documented in WDFW's periodic status review, but the distribution of lynx in Washington is contracted significantly from its historic range, and the boreal forest in western Okanagan County provide the only habitat now that have a resident lynx population. And threats pretty much include loss and fragmentation of habitat, and that's primarily from the wildfires that have gone on over there, but also from timber harvest. And also because of the small population size in Lynx now, there's only a documented 54 individuals left of Lynx. So as far as the implications from this uplisting, what the next steps are is that at 30 days after a listing decision is final, DNR provides a recommendation to the board after consulting with WDFW, and that recommendation obviously is to see if there's any recommended next steps or rule changes or changes in voluntary or protection strategies. Also, what Department of Fish and Wildlife is doing currently is we're reviewing all the lakes management plans, and the primary one is the DNR Loomis Lynx Management Plan, and we're working with the land, but then there's also two large landowners that have expired two-year plans, and we've already started having conversations with them on that. A lot of this involves looking at the landowners' more current data, what their harvest plans are, forest health treatments, looking at what type of habitat they have for forage habitat, etc. And then looking at more current scientific information, which has been quite a bit more since a lot of these plans originated. So we'll be working with the landowners specifically and with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and other conservation partners on working on the best way to update these plans as necessary to protect the lakes. As far as small forest landowners, there are a few that exist in the critical habitats areas, but there's been very little activity with that, and instead of trying to go to each one and develop a plan, we have focused more, we're focusing more on, as we screen FPAs, we will see those and we can work directly with those forest landowners if the need arises in those situations. As far as having more details on next steps, I think that's going to involve sitting down with DNR, and we're having internal discussions as well as what network gaps and possible gaps and recovery strategies are needed. But you'll be seeing, I think, a letter from DNR probably coming around March 5th or so. So that will involve our recommendations, or DNR's recommendations after talking with us as well. So then moving on to the marble murrelet. Again, on February 4th, a lot happened on February 4th. But the decision from the Fish and Wildlife Commission to uplist the marble murrelet to endangered went into effect on that date as well. And this decision as well was based on a periodic status review that the Department of Fish and Wildlife conducted. And pretty much at sea population monitoring from 2001 to 2015 showed a 4.4% annual decline in the populations. And this represents 44% decline since 2001. That's pretty significant. And the primary threats to marble murrelet include loss of old forest nesting habitat and a lot from commercial harvest. And with that, there's an estimated loss of 30% of nesting habitat on non-federal lands since 1993. So that's been a lot back. Another threat is also mortality associated with gillnet fisheries and oil spills. And so without solutions to deal with some of these threats in the short term, we're likely to see a functional extirpation washing within the next couple of decades. So we definitely want to look at this. And again, as with the lynx, there will be a letter coming to the board from DNR after consulting with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and that letter, again, will probably be around March 5th, where DNR will provide recommendations to the board on any possible rule changes or next steps. And so, is there any questions at this point?
Remember, Mark.
Thanks. Can you give us an idea of what the range of both murrelets and lynxes are? I mean, we're talking about their habitat here in Washington State, but are the murrelets in Alaska, for instance, what the populations are elsewhere?
I don't know that I can tell you too many details beyond Washington. They are in Oregon.
I thought you were going to range.
Okay.
Yes, you wanted.
Go ahead.
So for murrelets, there is a population in Alaska, and then down the coast in British Columbia, and Washington, and Oregon, and California.
Do we know how they're doing?
Not well either.
4% a year loss.
Everywhere.
4% of Washington.
But yes, there are declines in other parts of the range, but I think ours is one of the worst.
So what about lynx?
And they're more the boreal forest, the northern hemisphere. They were more in northeastern Washington, came down. I don't have a map in front of it. There are like 5 lynx management zones. But right now, they're just existing as that resident population in Okanagan. And of course, in Canada.
In Colorado. There's a reintroduced population in Colorado as well.
Well, 54 in Washington. It sounds pretty dire. I'm just wondering how the whole population is.
Any other questions for Terry? So you'll be seeing a memo from DNR to us. It sounds like it's for Canadian lynx, if I can paraphrase what I heard him say. You're going to be working with the large landowners up in the north central part of the state within their range to see what, if anything, needs to be done to update voluntary management plans they have.
Mm-hmm.
If the board will remember, lynx is one of the species where we do not have rules. We have, because landowners are willing to step up and work with state fish and wildlife on individual management plans to deal with their needs. Murrelets, on the other hand, we have a whole bunch of rules on. And it's unclear what we're going to be being asked to do in March. Is that right? On murrelet?
It is unclear at this point.
Okay. Board member City.
So I don't know the status of the discussions or what you guys are thinking about for recommendation, but I do remember years ago, and I somewhat hesitate to bring this up, but there was a comprehensive review of the spotted owl rules. It just went through, and the Conservation Wildlife went through all the elements of the rule and how is it being implemented. And I'm wondering if that might be part of the recommendation, is looking at all the aspects of the current rule. And are they actually protecting
birds? Well, not so preliminarily. We were talking about doing a little assessment for the murrelet, just to see how the rules are working, and possibly, recommend that we get a stakeholder group together to look at how the rules are protecting the habitat. But it's not preliminary.
Okay. Any other questions for Terry? Want to add to that? Remember David? No? Okay. All right, thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Mark, you want to talk about work plan?
Thank afternoon again. Mr. Chair, members of the board. In your packet, you have the board's 2017 work plan. Staff has highlighted in red those things that we anticipated a change, would have a change today. I'd like to quickly go through them and then the board can approve the work plan as amended. The alternate plan template, we may have been a little optimistic. We put down August, but I think that's a good aspirational goal. We moved it back, knowing that we had to get the literature synthesis and review done. This is about the small person on the template. For the policy committee type and
studies meeting, just a second. So, I got the sense from the conversation you and Ken gave me that we're a year or two off. So, what should that date be?
So, this is for the recommended review process and the timeline. So, the first step from the board, or to, from policy to the board, is that we will bring forward recommendations based on our review of the proposal initiation. And the recommendations now may be it is a template or it's not a template, or there may be some elements within it that we can do a template. But there'll be a form of, there'll be a series of recommendations from policy. Accompanying those recommendations will be a timeline that policy believes will need to be, that they will need to have in order to finalize the recommendations. But a proposal initiation is actually owned by the board, and it's a request for the adaptive management program to review the request that's contained within it, bring back recommendations, and then if the board approves those recommendations, then the adaptive management program does more work to develop that final product for the board. So this first date would be that initial step, that initial reporting back to the board from the adaptive management program, in this case the new policy, as to their feelings about that proposal initiation and what is possible. Okay, thank you. The next thing that was discussed today is TFW policies type in recommendations. There is no date here, but there is an acknowledgement that there is still very important work that needs to be done, and that this is said now that upon completion of the permanent water typing rule, which is many have called the type F work, that will be the next priority for policy to work on. That's most likely going to be after this calendar year, but we want to maintain this on the list of priorities so it's not lost. We're keeping it in front of the board.
I know there's been several comments about type N during the public comment and so forth. Seems like the parties at the table, that once you bring us recommendations in May and for water typing, we sort of shift into rulemaking or manual stuff, and it seems like what might be an appropriate thing is for TFW policy to do a quick assessment on where we're at, review where we're at on type N, and if they can't see a path forward, it seems to be appropriate for one of the parties to pull the dispute resolution card and get that thing moving again. So, just a suggestion.
So, based on the suggestions and review, policy needs to review the status, knowing that, and that is a very appropriate observation, that the board will at the May meeting receive recommendations from policy regarding the permanent water typing rule. With that, there will be some certainty. In other words, the recommendations the board chooses to pursue, then policy will and the NARA staff to the board will go forth and begin to produce and develop the next product for the board. So I made note that there'll be a report to the board at the May meeting. It's not that they'll be done, but there'll be a status report regarding type N. The next red is the TFW Policy Committee's funding decisions. That is in error, or I said February, it's actually May. It's at the board's May meeting, the decision is going to be regarding the budget.
Maybe you should say, you might want to be more descriptive about them. Priorities for expenditures on the master plan, master project schedule. Thank you.
Okay.
Noted.
Under the annual reports, the compliance monitoring by annual report is at ISPO. We checked in with our ops folks and they believe that August would be the meeting in which the results from ISPR would be made available, so we changed that date to August. Under board annual development, as the board heard today through the pesticide working group, that board manual section 12, which is the guidance for the application of those chemicals, needs to be amended. And it is somewhat antiquated. There's a lot of material in there that's not current. So we put down the date that was proposed today, which is May of 2018. Again, that's not in this year's work plan, but we want to make sure the documents of the board is aware that some of this, where it stands within the priorities of board manual development. Going down further, it's for the field tour, it says to be determined. The chair has proposed today that the board consider the month of June as when the field tour would be. I'm prepared to put that in for direction. Right now it says to be determined.
Yeah, let's say June question mark.
June slash, well, that's a little more firm than to be determined. The electronic signature vote making, the half board action today, we're suggesting that the board's November meeting will be when the board consider adoption of the rule. That would be the CR 103. The CR 102 would probably occur about 3 months before, so we have the August meeting. And that is the extent of changes to the work plan that you approved at your last meeting.
Yeah, let's go. Board Member Mills.
I had a question for you. We talked about the audit this morning for financial performance of CMR and policy. Is that something that would be included in this work plan, or is that something that would be done outside of this plan?
Good question.
I'd volunteer to bring that up also. I'd like to see it.
Okay.
So,
well,
we or the lean projects.
Right. Okay, so I'm fairly certain we'll be able to do the financial audit within this calendar year. I don't know when we're going to get the performance audit, so I don't think that should be added to the calendar yet. Maybe in May I'll be able to be specific about that. We also made some other commitments, voluntary commitments for May. Joe is going to do a performance measures report. And
compliance performance measures.
Yes. And what else do we have? Hans was going to bring back some recommendations after talking to stakeholders about things to consider regarding the gap management system. And the lean report is going to come in May. that capture everything?
Those things pertinent to the adaptive management program, we can put within the adaptive management under that heading, and we'll add them for names. We don't, I realize we don't have, I would ask, would you like to have the compliance performance measures report become an annual report? We could put that under annual reports, or
about a biannual.
Okay, biannual, okay.
Any other additions from board members?
I just wanted a clarification. So the critical habitat as needed, that's where in, that kind of covers the links of Marble and Mirrorlet stuff that will be coming back to us.
Right, so the report about the change in the status of state listed species within the rule 52-1608-0, every time there's a change, if a letter is generated for the board. That is independent from the quarterly board meetings. So there's a time frame that DNR, in consultation with DFW, within 30 days submits a letter to the board. That is oftentimes something, if there's a needed discussion for potential change in rule, then we would add it at the next quarterly board meeting as an agenda item. But it's kind of a standing, it's a standing rule that every time there's a cause and effect, when the Fish and Wildlife Commission takes measure to change the status, then within 30 days, we'll initiate the letter.
Yes.
Okay. Would somebody like to entertain a motion?
I'll do that. I move the Forest Practice Board approve the 2017 work plan as amended.
One second.
Thank you. Any discussion? Everybody in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion passes. All right. Last motion of the day, or last, excuse me, last item of the day. It's funny, it's divided up into three parts. So Phil's actually going to come up here and help us kick off on this last piece. Good afternoon, board members. I'm Phil Barrister, your counsel. I think board members and maybe some of the audience are probably aware that the board's May 2016 action to approve board manual section 16 concerning unstable slopes was challenged in court. That challenge was called Sumas Mountain Community for Landslide Awareness and Jeff Kenner versus the Forest Practices Board. It was filed in King County Superior Court. I, on your behalf, moved to dismiss that case, and the Superior Court in January granted the board's motion to dismiss that case. That motion was joined by Washington Forest Protection Association, who intervened as a party in that case. After the dismissal, there was an offer to settle the case. I believe that settlement offer is on the front table, and the board will need to take up the business of what to do about the settlement offer today. And that's really all I have to say at this point. There will be an executive session later, but that's sort of setting the table of what this is about. And why we're here for this part of the agenda. Any clarifying, and I'm saying that on purpose, clarifying questions for Bill from board members? You're thinking about it. Board Member Capra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you could provide, just for someone who's not an attorney like myself, a little bit of clarity just around how that works, basically. So what we're sort of being asked of as far as considering a settlement, and how that process works when a case is dismissed, and then a settlement's brought forward. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but just any kind of clarity.
Well, that's okay. I didn't bring the offer with me. It's on the front table. But in broad terms, petitioners in the Superior Court made an offer to not appeal the Superior Court's decision any further, and to not bring certain other types of lawsuits that challenge board rules or challenge other board manual provisions. So the settlement itself lays out in 5 pages worth of specificity various things that they wanted the board to do in order for them to waive those legal rights of challenge.
That's
settlements of matters in dispute can occur at all various times of a legal dispute, from before a case is even filed, a matter that could become a case can get settled. There can be years worth of litigation and then a settlement can occur, or a settlement could even occur after particular points in the litigation process, like after a motion decision, for example. So it's not heard of for a proposal to come at this particular stage.
Thank you. That does. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. So, is there people signed up for public comment? So we're taking public comment today because we the outcome of the, if the board chooses to take any action today post executive session, we wanted to be able to provide an opportunity for public comment before that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Board. I'm Peter Goldman. And today I am representing the families on Sumas Mountain and Mount Rainier National Park lead geomorphologist Paul Cannon. I've spoken to Mr. Ferrister, and I have, it is permissible for me to address this matter with you because he's here, because I'm doing it with all of you as a board in a public venue. So. excuse me for having my PC here, but things change so quickly during the day, including the agenda, that I just had to make changes to everything that I have to hear. It might seem a bit audacious and futile for me to try to convince you to settle a case that our side lost in a dispositive motion, but please let me explain why a settlement is in the best interest of the board, public safety, the public interest, and efficiency of this process. The fact of the matter is that also happened, 43 people lost their lives. Now, I am absolutely not here attributing the landslide on forest practices, but there were forest practices around the Hazel Landform, and DNR did settle this case for $50 million and granted for $10 million for the plaintiffs, 43 plaintiffs. Forest practices potentially contributed in some way to the landslide, though we may never now know without a trial the degree of contribution, and there are no studies exactly doing the work that the trial would have done, so we don't know. But as citizens and board members, this board that's responsible, has a duty to know, to do all it can do to make sure that the rules of the board manual are as precautious and technically sound as possible, especially in these days of very, very severe periodic storms. Let me first take a minute to describe the nature of what the court did and what the court didn't do. I think Mr. Fairster described the matter accurately, but I'd like to add a few details. We challenged the board manual that was adopted in May 2016 because we believe it failed to implement the Class 4 rule. Now, remember, the Class 4 rule is just a description of the landforms. That's it. Just a few words in each landform, and then everything gets delegated to a board manual. We argued that the board manual did not implement the rule, that it was that the board manual itself was unsafe because it failed to consider numerous things about how forest practices could affect landslides. For example, in reactivation of older landslides, what's a relic landslide, what's not, failed to require essential investigation steps on the site, and I'm not going to go down the list. The board argued in court that we had no right to be there because the board manual was not agency action. If you only challenge something an agency does, it is quote-unquote agency action. And agency action has a legal definition in the Administrative Procedure Act, and that includes anything this board does that implements a rule. That's the word of agency action. So the court here said, I can't reach the merits of what you're saying because you don't, what the board did here was not agency action. And the board reasoned, and the court agreed, that it was not agency action because the board manual wasn't a rule, quote unquote. It wasn't directly enforceable. It was something that the board adopted as guidance for the rules, but under precedent, the court found that that itself is not a, something that's appealable. So it's a technical decision on whether we had a right to be in court. The court did agree with the DNR's argument. And this is, so basically the court applied the reasoning that another court in what we call the Quinault case, where the court there said that the board manual is not a rule, but the DNR still has to follow it. So there's a lot of ambiguity over what's the rule, what's the board manual, what's enforceable, what's appealable. So there's a lot of gray area in this field. We argued, however, that the board manual was agency action because the rules tied to the board manual incorporated them by the reference, and because the board manual filled in the blanks of the rule. In other words, the board manual, the description of a glacial deep-seated landslide has seven words, and then says seek board manual for everything else. The water typing rule says if you haven't determined fish presence or absence through the board manual, then you have to use the physical. The channel migration zone rule does the same thing. And I'm not trying to infer that the board somehow developed a set of rules that was trying to slide stuff into the board manual to avoid making them enforceable. The fact of the matter is that those terms came from the Forest and Fish Report and were put into the rule when the board adopted the Forest and Fish Report. So they were never, that's the way it came to the board. It's not this board's fault, so to speak, that they're there. No one's trying to say the board is doing this on purpose. But that's just the way the world is. The board adopted the Forest and Fish Report, which describes things, and just basically gave the board manual the authority to do everything else. So the problem here, of course, is that you have a rule that has a narrative description of something, and the board manual says what it is, where it is, how you look at it, how you analyze it, how you deal with it, and DNR every day has to make decisions whether or not to approve an FPA based on matters in the board manual. It's the rules of the road. So yes, the court did agree with the board that the board manual was not agency action, but however, the court did suggest in language, and I hope you've all read the opinion, that if we have a problem with the way the rule ties to the board manual, we certainly have another remedy, which is going to court and putting the rule in front of the judge and saying, Judge, this rule cannot be enforced without a board manual, and the board manual hasn't gone through rulemaking, therefore the rule is invalid because it's depending, it tiers to and relies on, depends on the board manual. So we could do that, and the court admitted that in so many words, that was a different kind of case that we didn't bring. And we didn't bring it because that was not the case. We challenged the board manual. We didn't want to bring that case. It's not that we didn't know we could bring it, but we had a 30-day clock ticking on the board manual. We had to do something. So anyway, so where are we today? we're left with rules that came from the Forest and Fish report that really rely heavily on the board manual for implementation. And yet now we cannot challenge the board manual because it is not a rule or enforceable rule. So the board can put a lot of things that are rule like in the board manual, and there's nothing we can do about it except complain. And secondly, we're left in a situation based on the Quinault case that we can have things in the board manual that DNR has the discretion out in the field to just ignore, because it can say, like it did in the Quinault case, we think the CMZ doesn't go to the other side of the road. So even though the board manual says that a CMZ, there are pipes underneath, culverts under a road, the CMZ goes there, DNR has the authority to ignore the board's manual and do what it wants. So second situation we're left in is not only cannot appeal the board manual, but DNR doesn't have to enforce the board manual, and nor can anyone, that it's just guidance and it's only. So this is a shell game, is guess what I'm trying to say. It's not a great position for citizens to be in when we have a highly regulated industry, which we want to regulate with science and sound policy, but we have rules that are put in places that we can't do anything about, and we have in the form of guidance, and we're stuck not having them enforceable in the field. So imagine our position. We have essentially a no laws situation, no rules, nothing enforceable. That's not where citizens deserve to be in good government. So if the board rejects this settlement offer, we have options. And I'm going to get to why I think the board should accept this. But first, we can appeal the court's ruling. And if the appellate court agrees with us, there'll be a case on the books holding that the board manual is agency action, subject to review. And this could make the board manual very vulnerable and makes it much more difficult for the board to put things in a board manual. And it also might allow us to finally get a day in court whether or not this board manual soundly implemented the rule. So we could get there. And my clients, and we feel we have a very strong, we have a good case. We appreciate this judge, but just like President Trump is hoping for a different result, so are we. We can also file a petition for rulemaking, asking this board to move in all provisions that are rule-like, and we can identify them and highlight and say, folks, these are rule-like things in your board manual. You need to move them into the rule, and this board can tell us to go take a hike, and we can challenge that decision, the decision not to act, and we can make a big deal about things that are in the board manual that are really more like rules. And we'd rather not do that either. For example, water typing, 222.16.031, as I said, provides landowner can easier basically use the default or can electrofish. But that's all in the board manual. If we succeeded in challenging that rule, we would eliminate the ability to electrofish because you'd be stuck with the rule of the default. So if we challenge so we could use the water typing rule, we could use the steep slopes rule. As a test case, we could use anything we want to basically demonstrate that rules have to be, things that are effectively rules have to be rules. And things that are just calling something guidance and putting them in a board manual and saying, these are just guidance. If they look like rules, if they smell like rules, they are rules. And just calling them guidance in a board manual and saying they can't be enforced doesn't fix your problem that you have a rule that adheres to a board manual. And we can also resort to the court of public opinion. We can direct the public's attention to the fact that since the 2007 landslides that were mentioned this morning, we haven't had one rule that's changed. 2007, you know, 9 years ago. Since the Oso landslide 2014, not one rule has changed. We have a board manual, new board manual, but we have problems with that board manual. We can do that. We don't want to do it, but we could do it. And I believe, I'm sure that Phil shared with you an op-ed that several geologists are prepared to submit. So our settlement asks for two really reasonable things. It simply asks for 5 pages, as Phil said. It simply asks for guidance in some form from the Attorney General on what can go in a rule, what can go in a board manual, what can go in a rule. Rules of the road for everybody. You know, now we don't necessarily need a formal Attorney General opinion. That's an offer. We need something a little bit more than a board training session or a brown bag lunch with Phil. But we need something that guides this board as it decides how to do this. Every day in policy, we hear, well, we can put this in a board manual, but we're not putting it in a rule. We're hearing this all the time. The rules have been, the board manual has become a crutch because the rules can only be revised after it's gone through a process. So the board manual has become kind of a crutch for the rules because it can be changed on a dime at DNR's whim and this board's adoption. And the second thing we ask for is the formation of an expert panel, a neutral expert panel, not affiliated with, you know, environmentalists, timber industry, DNR. We ask for it to be chaired by someone who we have, we believe, is probably the most highly qualified person in this area, who will tell us that a lot of logging on landslides is just fine. He's not going to tell us that you got to log on landslides, but he's going to say what you need to do. So we want three experts to take a fresh look at the board manual so we know what's in that manual is set, but only inform the process. So in exchange for these vital pieces of information, you know, what we would put down our guns, not appeal anything, put everything on ice for, we've offered a period of 12 months where we don't do anything. Let's get these two vital pieces of information. We have not overreached in the sense that we have not purported to tie this board's hands or DNR's hands. You read the settlement proposal, all we say is, this information goes to you, and you decide what to do with it. Now, we did put a November 2017 timeline on it. That's too optimistic. Bill has my phone number. But we think that everything we offer there would get us two vital pieces of information that will only help this board. Does not usurp the rulemaking process that this board controls. Doesn't usurp the policy or science process that we participate in every day. But simply is 100% consistent with all those things. It would get us useful information. And again, we do not purport to, nor can we, tie this board's hands. You could say, great information, but you know what? Thanks, we don't need anything. You know, we think everything's fine. Now, I know I'm about to get the trap door open here in a minute, and or less, but the, I want to say one more point, because it's the elephant in the room. Some might say, why settle with these guys? They lost, bad precedents, capitulate to litigation, get there through the system, go to meetings, come to us, to go to legislators, but what? Why would we want to reward someone for litigating? Well, first of all, I want to make sure everybody knows that my law firm and my clients, the Conservation Caucus in general, has not brought a case in 9 years against this board. And that was back in the Spotted Owl litigation, which led to a settlement which, you know, which was constructive. We haven't sued the board. All we do is go to meetings. We go to every single policy meeting, every single forest practice board meeting, every single CEMER meeting. We are playing by the rules and by the books. Not one of us, we haven't seen you in court. We are not using the courts to go around the proper process. You're not, we did here because we believe that the principle, there are too many important principles at stake, and we have a respectful disagreement on what the board manual can do, and we didn't believe the board manual was safe, and our experts told us that, so we went ahead. So we are not litigious, even though one might think we are. Second, we're not tying your hands. We're getting you two vital pieces of information. So, I know that it is not easy to, you know, to move forward in this way because, but I think that it really, it's a very collaborative way to do it. Nobody will admit fault, nobody will admit anything. The settlement agreement is open to negotiation. We don't have a time clock ticking. We are going, Phil knows this, we are gonna file the notice of appeal, we have to. The date is Friday. We got it, you know, it's just, we can put it on ice. We don't have to, nobody's going to make a decision in the next 3 days whether a settlement goes or not. There's no time. We're going to file the notice. We could put the whole thing on ice and wait and hopefully negotiate. You can authorize Phil to negotiate with us and WFPA. We've already had a meeting last Friday, which I thought was constructive. But we have time. But I think to say no to this, basically kicks a problem down the road. And why would the board not want that basic information? What can go in a board manual, what can't? And what, you know, take a fresh set of eyes at this board manual. Can we make it better? Because it's probably going to be a few years before we change any rules as a result of this process. I mean, look at Type F has taken 10 years to get us where we are right now. And, you know, so my guess it'll probably take 5 or 7 more years to change the rule. So why not have a fresh look at the board manual so the board can take it into account, maybe improve it, and we can move on and collaborate here. So that's my pitch. Thank you very much for hearing me out. And Mr. Chair, thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. Karen Zoller.
Good afternoon, Chair Burnett and members of the Forest Practicing Board. For the record, my name is Karen Kubeliger. I'm a senior forester with the Washington Forest Protection Association. It's very late, and so I'm going to be very brief. As was reported earlier, WFPA was an intervening party to this lawsuit, and we do believe that the court reached the correct decision, that guidance documents are guidance documents and enforceable. They help to put forward and give pathways of compliance to a landowner, but in and of themselves, they are not enforceable. That's pretty clear in the Administrative Procedures Act as well as the Forest Practices Act, where the legislature has asked the Forest Practices Board to create technical guidance documents for the assistance for landowners. Secondly, the difference between a board manual and a rule is really that the board manual doesn't go through the adaptive management process. So it doesn't have the enhanced review and assessment through the science process that a rule does. And that's one of the reasons it's not enforceable under the Forest Practices Act. Third thing is just to think about unstable slopes. We have one of the strongest, if not the strongest, standards in terms of dealing with unstable slopes in forestry in the United States. It's nearly a zero risk standard for any creation of instability that would result in delivery to public resources or threats to public safety. It is an extremely strong standard. And we have spent the last 2.5 years or more going through a board manual process, going through a review of the forms to determine whether or not board manuals, rules, forms, or procedures needed to be changed. And we've made a lot of those changes. There were no issues that rose to the level of a change in the rule because they hadn't gone through the adaptive management process. And so as you heard earlier, there's been, I think it was maybe 8 pages of activities that the stakeholders, as well as DNR and CMER, have started to go through to analyze the issues that were brought forward, to put those issues squarely into the adaptive management process so that the science could be assessed as to whether or not changes in the board manual or changes in the rule needed to happen. That process is ongoing. And we see the process that that Mr. Goldman has brought forward as a duplication of that process. We already have experts in the field that are looking through those pieces of science. And actually, if Dr. Montgomery would like to join CMER in doing that, I think he would be a welcome participant in that process. So there's a process ongoing for this discussion. There's a process that fits in with the way that the Forest Practices Board goes through the adaptive management process to create the opportunities for rule changes or board manual changes. And so with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Not?
Thank you, Karen. All right, we're gonna go into executive session. The purpose is to discuss with legal counsel representing the board the settlement offer in the Sumas case against the board. We expect the discussion to take approximately 30 minutes, and then we will reconvene in the public. So if you could please clear the room.